We're beginning Masechta Bava Metzia and Ein Yaakov, page Yud Ches. Beginning of Bava Metzia, you have the case of Shnayim Osim Batalis, and that leads the Gemara into a whole discussion about various aspects of Dinim Momenus, one of them being the whole concept of Moedu B'Mikzas. We know that you have the case where Reuven says to Shimon, you owe me X amount. Shimon says, I owe less than that. Then it's one of the three cases in HaTorah where a person has to swear. You have three cases in HaTorah where a person swears and is potter. Then you have a number of cases in the Rabbanan also where a person swears sometimes to collect money. Those are all discussed in more detail in the Masechta Shavuos. Anyway, in the course of that discussion about Moedu B'Mikzas, which after all you have in the Mishnah, you have the case where one of them says Kola Shali and the other one says Chetzi Shali is a form of Moedu B'Mikzas. So the Gemara brings up a point, that the Gemara brings up a couple of dinim that Rav Chiya says. One of them is that the case of Moedu B'Mikzas can be not only where the person himself, let's say Shimon, admits that he owes 50, but also Rav Chiya presents a case where Reuven says to Shimon, you owe me 100. Shimon says, I owe 0. Now, if that was where it stopped, it would be Koifer Hakol. He's denying the whole thing, and then Atorah, there's no Shavua. But now, the twist is that Edim come and say that Shimon owes Reuven 50. So Rav Chiya says that would be a case of Moedu B'Mikzas as well, and Shimon has to swear that he doesn't owe the other 50. So the Gemara discusses various ins and outs of that, and then the Gemara brings the following story. Ahu Raya, there was a shepherd, every day people would give him their animals to watch, and they would have Edim when they're giving him the animals, so that they can so that way in case later on he denies that he received them, then they have Edim that they had given him X number of animals. Yom Echad must relate by Sadi. One day, they got careless. They gave it to him without Edim. So, in the end, he took advantage of it and said, it never happened. You never gave me any animals. However, also Sadi, as Hidube de Ochel Tauti Minayu. Edim came and said that he had been given animals and he had eaten two of them. So this is the case. This is the case like Rav Chiya. They're saying you owe us X number of animals. He's counterclaiming and saying, I don't owe any. And Edom come and say you owe two. Amr Rav Zera. So Rav Zera says, even Isa the Rav Chiya Kamaisa, if we accept Rav Chiya's first din, he has a second din later in the Gemara over there, also about Moedu B'Mikzas, but if we accept Rav Chiya's first din, Mishtaba Ashora, then the din will have to be that we're going to have this shepherd swear about the rest of them. Like this, they're claiming from him that they left for him with safekeeping for him, let's say 10 animals. Now he's claiming he never received any animals. Edom are saying that he ate two of them, so he certainly owes for those two. What about the other eight? So Rav Zera is saying, apparently he's going to have to swear on the other eight, if we accept Rav Chiya's din.
There was no Edim that he accepted any.
Right.
There was Edim that he ate two.
But there's Edim that he ate two.
Of what?
Two animals. No, two there weren't any Edim that saw the animals being given to him, but there were two Edim that came and said that he ate, that of the animals that the people are claiming that they gave to him, the Edim say that he ate two of them. Where would he have gotten these animals from? Pasha, he didn't have animals of his own. So, yeah. Okay. So, Omalei Abayas. Abayas says, what do you mean, Issa Mishtabi? What do you mean, if we accept Rav Chiya's din, then he's going to swear? V'ha-gazlan hu v'cholu. Isn't he a gazlan? And a gazlan is possible edus. And we don't mean a gazlan because of this edus. That itself, we don't know yet whether what these edim are saying, we have what the edim are saying, but that doesn't necessarily establish him as a gazlan yet, but the point is, the question is actually that he's a gazlan. The question is, we have Edom against him that he stole two animals and ate them. That itself is enough to brand him as a gazlan and therefore not be able to, Mela, in Rav Chiya's case, for example, where they're saying that Shimon owes Reuven 50, is not necessarily a gazlan for it. Reuven had lent him money, Shimon thought he paid back or whatever. Whatever it is here, the guy is claiming he never received the animals in the first place, and he certainly has no business shechting and eating if they're not his. So therefore we have good reason, says Abaya, to call him a gazlan. So the Gemara goes on with the Chulos, so the Gemara goes on with the discussion. Fine, it's not he's going to swear, it's actually going to have to be Shekinegdo, it's the opposite party in the Din Torah that's going to have to swear. The Gemara discusses this point in a number of places. You have something called Hipuch Shvua. Sometimes you have a person is not able to take a Shvua in Beis Din for one reason or another, and instead the opposite party, Midrabanan, will take the Shvua and be able to collect instead. Like this, the Shvur Daraisa is always to be potter from paying, but there are cases, again, there are cases, Zirabonon, where a person swears and collects on the basis of his oath, and one of those is where there's Hippuch Shvur, where it's flipped to the other person. However, then the Gemara goes on later on in the discussion. Why is Abaya bothered by the fact that he's a Gazlan because of these Edim? The typical way, don't we have a better reason that he's fossil to take a shvua anyway? To have a roya, he's a shepherd after all. V'omer Rabbi Yehuda stam roya fossil, and Rabbi Yehuda says that a roya is assumed to be fossil, even if we don't have specific edim on this particular one that he's a gazlan. Nevertheless, he's usually fossil la'edus and fossil la'shvua because he usually allows his animals to graze in other people's fields. So for that reason alone, he should be. So why is Abaya saying, but he's a Gazlan, as in, because now we have two Edom against him, then that creates problems. And without that, we would have allowed him to swear? How is that? So the answer is like Kasha Hodidei Hodalma. The answer is there's a difference whether he's grazing his own animals or other people's. As we learned in Baba Kama, you can't raise small cattle, sheep and goats in Eretz Yisrael precisely because you're likely to have them graze in other people's fields. Well, if it's his own animals, then yeah, he's likely to cut corners like that and feed them in other people's fields rather than muzzling them like Avraham Avinu did or feeding them himself because he figures he can get away with it. But Chod Alma, but if he's grazing animals for other people, he doesn't gain from having them eat in other people's fields. He'll wait until he gets to the grazing area, to the commons where he can have all the animals graze, and he'll do it that way. The Gemara points out, the Eloi Temahochi, after all, if it weren't like that, if we were going to say that every shepherd is presumed to be a Gazlan even when he's grazing other people's animals, because we would assume he always allows them to graze in other people's fields, well, then we'd have to ask, how would we even be allowed in the first place to give animals to a shepherd to watch? You have a mitzvah in the Torah not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind, meaning not to give another person an opportunity to do an aveira. So if it was the case that always a roya pastures his field, is the animal that he's watching in other people's fields, then it would be awesome, it's sad that, to give him animals to watch in the first place. Ella, rather, the answer is, that's not a problem because einon mechoyte v'loy loy. A person doesn't do an aveira where it's not for himself. He himself is not going to gain from grazing the animals in other people's fields when the animals don't belong to him. He has no problem going to the commons, to the public areas or the forests or whatever where he can graze the animals there. He's not going to bother taking them into other people's fields. So therefore, yes, this shepherd in the story over here, he's not grazing his own animals. It's other people's. And that probably also answers your question, how it is. So how do we know if the Edom are coming and saying that he ate two animals? The pastures, again, because he doesn't have any animals of his own. If he did, then anyway, we would call him a Gazlan on those grounds alone. But he was saying he's only taking care of other people's animals, so therefore, so we have a rule. He wouldn't be sinning, he wouldn't be doing the Aveira if he himself doesn't stand to benefit from it, and therefore we can assume that he's kosher, a kosher la'edus and kosher for sure, until we have this particular thing with the two Edim coming and saying that he ate the animals. So Abayna over here refers to, at the bottom of the page, refers to a number of places in the Torah where we talk about this point of people grazing their animals in other people's fields. We have Moshe Rabbeinu, for example, on the contrary, going to the nth degree, to going Achar Amidbar, all the way to a place which is completely Hefker, so there's not even a possibility that he's causing them to graze in somebody else's fields. You have on the flip side, you have Loitz shepherds, where we know that they were allowing their animals to graze in other people's fields. So he says that's the point. In other words, they were pretending that it's not Gezel, because like Rashi says on the Pasuk, they were pretending the whole land has been given to Avraham, and Avraham doesn't have an heir, and therefore Lot's taking it over anyway, and that's the excuse they used. If it hadn't been for that, then yeah, they wouldn't have bothered on this basis of Einonim Chote V'loy Loy. He's not gaining by him taking other people's animals. He's not taking by if he's grazing Reuven's animals. He doesn't if he's taking care of Reuven's. Actually, Rashi says of all the people, you know, all the people in town have animals and they're giving them to him to graze, to pasture, to take care of them. He doesn't gain anything by having them go into individual people's fields and eat. He's taking care of a whole bunch of animals anyway. He has no problem going to the common areas and letting them pass through there.
Because other people feel he's stealing from those people.
That's the point. He won't. If he's doing his own animals, he will, because then he figures he'll gain. Like this, he would have had to pay for hay or grass or whatever for them, and like this, he figures he gains by stealing from other people. But if he's taking care of other people's animals, he doesn't stand anything to gain anything by having them eat from other people's fields. He'll just go and take them to a hefker area. He mentions also, by the way, there's a nevuah from Yechezkel, a long nevuah that compares the Jewish people to a flock of sheep who have been terribly mistreated by their shepherds, representing the kings who really treated the Jewish people, the Jewish kings, that is, we're talking, let alone the Goyish kings, who caused so much trouble to Jews over the centuries. And Hashem promises that I'm going to gather all those sheep together, and I'm going to pasture them, I'm going to take care of them personally. So, and he uses the expression. And he says, that I'll have them graze on the mountains of the heights of Eretz Yisrael, representing, in other words, in terms of the Moshul, they won't be eating from other people's fields. There won't be any trace of Gezel. They'll be only in places that are Hefker. So this is the same idea. Okay. A few blocks later, the Mishnah talks about a case where one person sees a lost object, and he asks somebody else to pick it up for him. So you have cases where if the other person picks it up and has in mind to be koyneh it for himself, then he's koyneh it for himself. If he gives it to the one who asked him and then says, but you know what, I actually got it first, it's too late, the other guy waited and he made a kinyan on it. So that leads into discussions about cases. Let's say you hire somebody for a job and then that person finds a metziah on the job. Does the metziah belong to him or does it belong to you who hired him? So there's a difference what you hired him for, whether his job is directly, whether what you hired him for is directly related to finding this metziah and so on and so forth. So in the course of that discussion, then the Gemara brings up the point that the employee, that the worker can be considered like an extension of the hand of the Baal HaBayis. And therefore, when he picks up the metziah, then he can be picking it up automatically on behalf of the Baal HaBayis who hired him. So the Gemara asks, "V'ha'omer Rab, what do you mean that the worker is considered to be an extension of his employer?" "V'ha'omer Rab, poyo yochol lachzav yafilu b'chatzia yoyim." Doesn't it say? Didn't Rav say that a worker can quit the job even in the middle of the day? Later on, and the Gemara discusses it later on in the sixth paragraph, it discusses it in more detail, but there is a concept with certain exceptions, like for example, where it's something urgent that has to be completed now. Otherwise, you generally have in halacha that a worker can decide to quit the job anytime he wants. He'll get paid for the time he did so far. And obviously, he's not going to get paid more than that. But there's nothing that he can be forced to stay on the job until he finishes it.
If he can quit any time,
then why are we considering him an extension of the one who hired him? We should say that, in effect, when he finds the thing, he in effect walks off the job for a while and finds it and keeps it for himself, and then he's back on the job. Why should we consider that? Why should we consider that automatically it belongs to the one who hired him? So the answer is omale. So the answer is kol kamad lehodabe. That's true, but nevertheless, as long as he doesn't change his mind, as long as he doesn't quit the job, he yad balabaisu, then he's considered like the hand of the balabais. So therefore, yes, when he finds this thing, it automatically belongs to the balabais under the relevant conditions. Kihot.
Where the assumption begin that the work is an extension of the
Well, that's what we're saying. That's what the Gemara was saying. That, for example, you have a case where take for example a case where somebody hires somebody else to collect metzias, to collect found objects. An example of that the Gemara gives, let's say, for example, that a river or a pond recently flooded over its banks, and now the water receded, and you have a lot of fish left over on the side. So you hire somebody to go and gather all those stranded fish. So now then they're going to belong to the Baal HaBayis. So now the question was why? Why shouldn't we consider that he could be, in effect, collecting them for himself? So the answer is because as long as he remains in his job, as long as he remains in his employment, then he is considered like the hand of the Balabais, and therefore when he picks it up. That's what we're saying. We're talking about where he was hired to find lost objects. I just said, for example, this case where a river overflowed and you have stranded fish left.
A worker is not hired. He's hired to do a job, not to go find lost objects.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to explain. You can have a case. The Gemara distinguishes a case. You can, let's say, you hire a worker, let's say, to build a house for you, and in the course of it, he happens to find the treasure. That's one case. Then you have a different case where, to begin with, you hired him for a job finding treasures, or in this case, for example, picking up all the stranded fish that he can.
Okay, so which case are we talking about?
So we're talking about primarily the second case.
Oh, the second
case. So, yeah. So you hired him for that purpose, yeah. So the question is, though, can he quit the job anytime he wants based on what Rav says? And the answer is fine. But as long as he doesn't quit the job, he is still considered an extension of the Balabais. And therefore, when he picks up those fish or whatever, then automatically he's acquiring them for the Balabais. He hoder bay. Now, if he changes his mind and decides he doesn't want the job anymore and he wants to walk off, tainach rinuhu. There's a different reason in that regard why he's allowed to do that. Dichtiv, because the Pasuk says, Hashem says the Jewish people are my servants. They're my servants. They're not servants to other servants. Now, if you had, in other words, a person has, he has to stay on the job for as long as he was hired for, then that would be a form of avdus. That would be, in effect, making him, at least temporarily, into a slave. Now, Tosfos says, the fact is, a person is allowed to hire himself out for a person, for a period of time. A person can sign an employment contract that he's going to work for a certain amount of time. The difference is, an Eved Ivri, the difference is, so that's the thing, a person can sign such an employment contract. An Eved Ivri is sold for a certain period of time, and he can't unilaterally leave before that. He has to buy his freedom, or get a Shtar Shichru or whatever, as opposed to a regular employee is not. So a person can, in fact, sign an employment contract, and that he's going to work for X number of years, and that's not considered to be a problem. There are Rishonim who talk about that maybe it shouldn't be for more than 3 years, because we find a pasuk in Yeshaya that refers to a hired worker working for 3 years, implying that anything after that might be more like an Eved Ivri. But the concept of employment contracts for a certain period of time is valid, but you still have, al pi halacha, under certain circumstances, the worker is allowed to quit the job. Now you have, again, there can be cases where it's a time sensitive thing, and then not. Then later on in the Masechta, it talks about then the employer is entitled to hire new employees at the old employee's expense. A whole long point over there. This gets into an interesting question as far as strikes. There's things in among recent poskim, for example, about teachers' strikes, where they strike for more pay or whatever, whether to what extent that's allowed. Al pi halacha, or Gemara is one of the things that factors into that. But the point is, in other words, the Gemara had assumed that the fact that he can quit at any time implies that he's not so tied to the Balabais in the first place. The answer is no. He is tied to him as long as he stays on the job. And therefore, he can be considered an extension of the Balabais to the extent that when he finds the Metziah, then it automatically goes to the person who hired him. The fact that he can quit is a side point not directly related to that. Further on, a few blocks later, the last half of the first parak above Metziah, so the whole first parak and most of the second parak above Metziah deal with dinim involving lost objects, and the second parak focuses on the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. The first parak is more about the dinim of the object itself, when various kinds of objects, what you do with them when it's considered that you found it and when not. Anyway, the last half of the parak discusses cases where you find a shtar. Now, a shtar, you have more complications involved than you do with other things, because you have to consider, let's say, for example, with a shtar for a loan. Who dropped it? There's only two parties in the shtar that could have dropped it, either the lender or the buyer, the malva or the loiva. And if you give it to the malva when it's supposed to go to the loiva, then he's going to be able to collect with it again. And if you give it to the loiva, then you're whatever. So you have complications over there. You also have questions of whether maybe the document itself is valid, maybe it was forged, et cetera, et cetera. So you have all kinds of... What?
A
It was yesterday's Rambam, actually. It was yesterday's Rambam. Yeah, all about that. No, 2 days ago, I think. Whatever. Yeah. Whatever. It was very recently in Shlosha Prokham of Rambam. Yeah. So the Gemara spends many blot talking about all the ins and outs of these various halachas. In the course of that, eventually the Gemara gets into a side discussion, which also was recently in Rambam. Suppose that Reuven steals a field from Shimon. Now, at some later point, and then he sells it to Levi. So now the din is, it's not his to sell, so therefore eventually Shimon can go and take it back from Levi. What happens? You can have a case, for example, where Reuven sold the field to Levi, but afterwards he goes to Shimon, who he stole the field from in the first place, and he compensates him. Now, he's doing wrong by that, because we learned yesterday that's called chomos, that he stole it from him, but is giving him money after all. Nevertheless, though, in certain cases, then we say, then that prevents now that now Shimon can't go and take it back from Levi. So the Gemara gets into various discussions about all the details of that, and one thing, so eventually the Gemara asks as follows. So what are we saying, in effect? That Reuven is able to have sold this field to Levi, even though at that point it didn't belong to him, and after the fact he'll make good on it by compensating Shimon, and that retroactively makes the sale good. The question is that we find cases in Halacha where we find you can't sell Dovah Shalei Bala Olam. You can't sell something that doesn't exist yet or that you don't own yet. So how does that work? So then he was where we pick up in Yaakov, Omar Romi Bahama, Ho Gabra Bahot Yovta. There is the man, and there is the answer. Meaning this was Rav Sheshes that pointed out this contradiction, and Rami Bar Chama says, I'm very impressed. This is a great man, this is a great Talmud Chacham, Rav Sheshes, and he has a great answer. He answers that in fact it can't work like that with this case of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Based on that, because how could Reuven be validly selling with a document saying, I own this field, and I'm selling it to you, Levi, one at a time, he doesn't own the field. Rava says, Gabra Kachazina. Yes, I see the man. Rav Sheshes is a great Talmud Chacham. Utiyuvta le Kachazina chula. But the answer, I don't know, the reputation, I don't consider to be such a great reputation. You can draw a distinction between that and the case of a person selling Dabra Shalai Balarlam. So the Gemara continues the discussing and eventually it says Shalchur Kameh Rav Abba Bar Zavda. Eventually they sent the question to Rav Abba Bar Zavda. Omalei, so he answers to the people who brought the whole discussion. He says, "Zu einat sricha lefnim." This does not need to be brought inside, meaning into the Beis Medrash. So Rashi has two explanations. One is Rav Zavda is saying, you know, this really is a very good question and a very good contradiction. Let's not even bring it into the Beis Medrash because we're not going to find anybody in the Beis Medrash who's going to be able to figure out the answer. Yeah, the opposite, then Rashi says, the opposite explanation Rashi brings from the Goyim, on the contrary. This is something that's not even worth asking, don't even bother bringing it into the Beis Medrash, because it's not really a good question in the first place. Omar Rava, but Rava disagrees, and says, Zut Sricha Lefnim V'Lefnai Lefnim. This needs to be brought inside, and the inside of the inside. So on the contrary, we need to bring this all the way into the highest levels of the Beis Medrash, because yeah, this is a very strong question that Rav Sheshes pointed out, and we need a very good answer to it. So we see, in other words, that sometimes you can have a question. Sometimes you can have a question that on one level it seems to be like what kind of a silly question is that? But then you delve into it and you realize this is actually an excellent question, and you know nobody ever thought about it before. So on the side over here in Chedusha Ga'onim, there's a piece from Torah Chaim that gives a different explanation that says that Rava is also saying not only does it need not only does it not need pnim, but on the contrary, a different girsa that from the Oruch zu einet zricha lefnim v'lefnai v'lefnim, that Rava is dismissing the question and saying it doesn't even need to be brought inside, and it doesn't even need to be brought to the outside of the Beis Medrash. It's so easy to answer that we don't even need to discuss it any further. Further on, it talks about, the Mishnah mentions that among the documents that a person might find, and you have to discuss to whom he should return them, is things called Maisa Beistin. Now, you have like this. Again, when it comes to, let's say, you find a document saying that Reuven lent money to Shimon, then you have to figure out who are you supposed to return it to Reuven or to Shimon. But let's say, for example, you have... to give an example from the Mishnah over there, you have something called Igres Shum. You have, for example, that the Beis Din will, where you get to a point, Reuven has previously borrowed money from Shimon and has defaulted on the loan, and now Shimon is entitled. There's a long process where eventually the upshot of it is that Shimon is going to be able to go and then collect and take some of Reuven's properties, and in the course of that, Beis Din will write out a document called Igres Shum, which is a Shum, a Lashon Shuma, where they evaluated and found that a property is worth, that a certain property is worth X amount. You have other examples like that where Beis Din has to evaluate the value of something in terms of, for example, an almana, for example, needs to sell property that was left by her husband in order to support herself, etc. You have a variety of examples. So Beis Din will write out a document called a Maisa Beis Din, giving the details of that. So in that kind of case, you find such a thing, then there's no problem returning it because there's no two parties involved, and therefore it's fine. So then, yeah, if there's an achosim mishabodim, then it gets a little more complicated. But yeah, the point is that you have this basic point that sometimes you have certain mice based in that it's straightforward that you can return them. Yeah. So in this connection, Amar Rav Chiya ba'Abba Amar Rav Yochanan hatoyin acha mice based in. If a person argues against a mice based in, so let's say for example, Rashi gives an example of a mice based in would be for example ksuba. So the woman had, let's say, for example, a couple got divorced, and now the woman has the ksuba in her hand and is saying, I haven't yet received my ksuba payment. And the husband claims, I already paid it. So then, so Rav Chiya ba'Abba says in the name of Rav Yochanan, loy oma klum. Then the claim doesn't count for anything. If he says I paid, and Rashi says, if he says Shaloi Be'edim, if he has Edim, that's different, but if he says I paid and doesn't have Edim, then we don't listen to anything he says. My time, I call Maisa Beis Din, can command the knock at Shtar of a Yodadami. Because whenever we're talking about a Maisa Beis Din, it's considered as though they're holding a Shtar. So in this case, we're not even talking about actually where the woman actually has the physical ksuba in her hand. Because there's a maisa basin, because there's a takana, that there has to be a ksuba paid, then if he wants to claim that he paid it, then he's going to have to bring edim to that effect. In other words, the same way as if Reuven has a document that says Shimon owes me $100, and Shimon wants to say, I already paid you, then we're going to tell him, wait a minute, well then why does Reuven have the shtar? Why don't you get it back from him and rip it up? Or why don't you have a receipt saying, or why don't we have a receipt saying that it was paid off? But here,
he has the ksuba.
So here apparently we're talking about she doesn't necessarily have the ksuba. Sometimes,
even though she doesn't have the ksuba,
nevertheless we're still saying that if he wants to claim against Maisa Beis Din, then loyal maklum, yeah.
If she knows that she's a butler and never puts things away, so she can take a chance and claim it.
Doesn't even have the ksuba.
Well, there is, no, but because we're talking about that we know that they were married. We know that they were married previously, so it's not like she needs to bring proof that she was married. So now if the husband wants to say that he paid, then he has to bring proof. He has to have a receipt.
That's why they believe the woman.
Because that's what we're saying, because there's a Maisa Beis Din involved over here, because we're saying that it's a Tanai Beis Din that he has to pay this amount of money. So now if he wants to say without Edim that I didn't pay, then we can't count it. So now Rav Chiya ba'Abba said this din in the name of Rav Yochanan, but then he asks, Omalei Rav Chiya ba'Abba l'Rav Yochanan, v'loi Mishnah Seinu Hizu, isn't this exactly what we said in the Mishnah? Hotsia get ve'eni maksuba, that if she brings out, so that's the case, she has a get. So if she has a get in her hand, she doesn't have the ksuba. But she has a get, which shows that she was married to this guy in his divorce. She doesn't have the ksuba. Not always, by the way, the Gemara mentions in the Masechta Ksubas, especially in those days, not always did they write out a physical ksuba. Given that there is a takonas based in, that you have to have a 200 for a besola, 100 for an almana, not always did they bother writing one out. Sometimes they would be sort of similar on the tanai based in. So she brings out a get, the edim ksuba, but she doesn't have the ksuba goiva ksubasa, she is able to collect her ksuba. So you see exactly the same point, even though she doesn't have the shtar that says that she should be owed that money, nevertheless, it's a maisa based thing.
Amalei. What ksuba means, a written document, so what do you mean?
Well, the get has to be a written document. By definition, you can't, what? Even though the word ksuba means written, yes, the word ksuba means written. However, nonetheless, the Gemara points out over and over in Masechta Ksubas that there were places in those days where they had the minhag not to write out a ksuba, but rather just to rely on the tanai based in and on edim.
How is that today, without a ksuba, you can't even live together in the same house?
Right.
So once it became established that there's Oksuba is always going to be written, then yeah, because that's the point. In other words, so when nowadays that we write out Oksuba and we're not Soymach on the Edim, then that means, in other words, without the Oksuba, so that's the difference. It's a difference of how it was decided, but what the Minig HaMokum is, basically. Nowadays, there's no Minig HaMokum when they don't write Oksuba, so yeah. Okay. So Rav Chiya Bar Abba asks, why do we need to say this din if we see it clearly in the Mishnah? Amalei, Rav Yochanan answers him, you're right, but ilav de deloy lo chaspa, if not for the fact that I had picked up the shard for you, a piece of earthenware, lo meshachas magunisa tusa, you would not have found the pearl underneath it. Meaning, in other words, it wouldn't be so obvious from that Mishnah that this is always the case. When a person argues and says that I paid something which is a maisa based in, we wouldn't necessarily derive that that's always the case. We see that in this particular case where she had, because after all, she does have a document she has a get. After all, you wouldn't necessarily know that it applies across the board. But now I, so to speak, lifted up the earthenware for you and made you realize that that's what the Mishnah means. And therefore you think that it's very obvious and we don't need it to be taught separately. Tosfos brings up the question. A mushal usually has to be something from real life, you know, something that usually happens. How often do you have that people pick up a shard of earthenware and find a pearl underneath? Where did this figure of speech come from? So Tosfos says, actually what it is, brings from Rabbeinu Tam, at the bottom of the sea, sometimes you'll find there are big flat stones which resemble pieces of earthenware. Another possibility, as Tosfos may mean, the shells of the oysters inside which the pearls form. And then you pick up those rocks, or you open up the shells, and you discover the pearl underneath. So that's what Rabbi Yochanan is telling Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, that it's not that you know the Mishnah, but you wouldn't have realized the full implication of that Mishnah unless you learnt it from me, your Rebbe. Ein Eliyahu, one of the Pirushim on Ein Yaakov, points out a different point as well. The Gemara tells us in Rosh Hashanah of a whole system that they would have in those days for harvesting coral from the bottom of the sea. And the Gemara mentions there was an area in the Persian Gulf where there was one area from which they would harvest coral and another one from which they would harvest pearls. And the Gemara discusses when they got the coral, there was a whole system involving over there a boat which they would partially sink and then refloat it, etc. Boats in those times sometimes were made out of earthenware. So therefore, and sometimes these boats would break and sink. So Ein Eliyahu says that can also mean that Tosfos is wondering, since when do you pick up a shard of earthenware and find a pearl underneath? Well, there's your answer. If the ship, suppose the ship was made out of earthenware and it broke up and sank, then yes, you might dive under the water and pick up a shard and find a pearl underneath. The Gemara, so further on, the Gemara discusses, you have, again, various cases of shtaris that you find and what the dinim are of returning them. The Gemara also gets into a whole discussion about the fact that a get is a little more complicated, because conceivably you could have two people of the same name, two men of the same name who have wives of the same name, and you find a get that Yitzchak ben Avraham divorced Rivka bas Lavan, and you don't know whether there might be two people of the same name in town. So the Gemara goes through various details of that. So the Gemara now tells the following story. Ahu gita de ishtakach bei dina de Rabuna. They once found a get in the base din of Rabuna. The get was already, Rashi points out, it had a henfit on it. It had a certification of base din that it's genuine. And you have a shliach base din who had brought it from someplace else and says that I dropped this get. So far, that ought to be good enough for us to consider it a legitimate get and to return it to him, and he'll finish up his shlichus and give it to the wife. Now, to have a cost, to have a ksibbe, the get was, it's stated in the get, where was it originally written? The Shviri Masa Dal Rochis Nara. It was written in the city named Shviri, located on the river Rochis. This Gemara, by the way, this is the only place, well, this story is repeated twice in Masechta and once in Masechta Gittin. This is the only place where we find an example of that formula in a get, that it says that it was written in such and such a city by such and such a river. The Poskim took that as a paradigm, as a basically a binyan ab, that whenever you write a get, you're always supposed to write. You write the name of the city and you write the names of the major waterways near it. So, for example, nowadays, you write a get is written in Brooklyn, they'll write that it's by the East River and it's by the sea coast and by the East River. A practical reason for it, the post can point out, is because Let's say you were to write Brooklyn, New York. And what if later on the political borders change? What if one day they decide that that Brooklyn should be spun off as part of the state of New Jersey? Let's say then what happens? So like this, where you put by the East River, that's not going to change, and the name of it is probably not going to change either. Anyway, so we see that example in the Gemara over here. So the question is, Rav Huna asks, Chayshin and Lebeis Shviri, do we have to be concerned that there's two cities named Shviri? So we know, let's say, that in the one city of Shviri that we know of, there's one fellow named Yosef ben Shimon, and this get has his name on it. But what if there's another city of Shviri that also has a Yosef ben Shimon in it, and it was a different shliach that dropped it, and not this one? Tosfos in Gittin discusses that another, so here Rashi explains that Rav Huna is saying it as a statement. Chayshin l'shnei shviri. Tosfos elsewhere discusses he's asking it as a question. Chayshin l'shnei shviri. Do we in fact have to be concerned that there are two different towns called Shviri, and maybe there's a person of the same name in the other one as well? And that would mean that we can't necessarily return this get to the shliach, because he's going to think that it's a get from Yosef ben Shimon Goldstein and give it to Yosef ben Shimon Goldstein's wife, and meanwhile it was supposed to be from Yosef ben Shimon Silverstein, let's say. Rav Chista, who was Rav Huna's assistant in the yeshiva, tells Rabba, who at the time was a Talmud in the yeshiva, Puk Ayin, go look into this. This evening, Rav Huna is going to ask you whether you have a proof from anywhere, from a Mishnah or a Braisa, about whether this is correct or not, whether we have to be concerned about there's another city of the same name. So in other words, Rav Huna he's a Talmud in the yeshiva, but this is part of his shimush. A rov has to learn practical shimush as well, so this is part of it. Rav Huna is going to be testing you on this. Nofak, he went out of the Beis Medrash, Dok, he checked into it, Va'ashkach, and sure enough, he found something. We often have this expression, Nofak, Dak, Va'ashkach. We actually had it in today's Dafad Yomi as well, in Zvachim, because not always when a Talmud Chacham needs to, in those days, needed to look up something. Remember, the Sforim weren't written yet, the Mishnayos maybe were written, the Braises certainly were not. He might have to go around and ask people outside the Beis Medrash whether they know of any relevant Braises. Not all Braises were taught in the Batei Midrashim. In some places, in fact, the Gemara says that a certain brisa is inexact or inaccurate or whatever, and we shouldn't even be bringing it into the Beis Medrash. So he would have to go out, ask among all the other Talmudim, and see if anybody knows anything. Well, eventually he found the Tanan. We have our Mishnah in Bava Metzia that says, "Kol Maisa Beistin Arezi Yachzir." Whenever you find a Maisa Beistin, you should return it, and a get is an example of a Maisa Beistin. So the answer is you should return it, and we don't have to be worried about that there are two cities of the same name with a person of the same name living in them. However, Omelet of Amram L'Rabba, he would return it to the shliach who says that he dropped it. There was a shliach who's saying, I was in Rav Huna's Beis Medrash, and I dropped the sket. One factor the Gemara brings in this connection is that Rav Huna's based in Shtibel is a busy place. People are always coming and going. Mela, if the shliach had said, for example, that he dropped it in a place where few people go, then he had much less of a concern. How likely is it that a shliach of another city of the same name happened to pass through here and also drop a get with the same names? But when you have Rav Huna's Beis Medrash, his based in Shtibel is a busy place, then you have that concern. But Rabba is saying, based on our Mishnah, it's not a concern. However, Omelet of Amram L'Rabba, but Rab Amram asks Rabba, Heifi poshit mar isurim imamoina. How are you trying to answer a matter of Isur Beheter from a matter of Mamoin? Yes, the Mishnah says that you can return a Maisa Beistin. You know why? Because a Maisa Beistin involves something involving monetary matters. So fine, worst comes to worst, we can say Hefker Beistin Hefker. But by a matter of Isur Beheter, like a get, how can you do that? How can you assume that you should return it automatically rather than being concerned, like Rav Huna said, that there might be another city of the same name? Omalei, so Rabba answers him very sharply. He says, Troda. Rashi translates Meshurmam, which means like a fool or somebody mentally unbalanced or something. In a different place, Rashi gives a different explanation that it means like a lazy person. That's another translation. It's Yosef brings that it means a fool. He brings also from the Aruch that the word is not tra-da with a dalad, but tra-ra with a resh, in which case it's maloshin rear, as in saliva, as in a person, like a drooling person, like in English we say a drooling idiot. Anyway, so he says, the Mishnah didn't just mention among its list of mice and basin, didn't just mention things involving dinim mominus. It also mentioned a shtar that a woman did chalitza with her yavam, or a shtar that a young girl did miun and doesn't want to be with her husband anymore. And those are matters of Issa v'Heter, those are also matters involving marriage, and yet the Mishnah is saying you can return them. So the same thing with the get. Now, Einar Leo points out, Rav Amram could well answer to that, that you know what the difference is. Those things involve at most a lav, a Yavoma marries out without getting a proper chalitza. There's a lav involved, and miyun is b'chalal on your dindir abonon. You can't necessarily prove from that to a get which is required to deraisa. But anyway, poka arza de be rav. This is a question on Rabba. What are you telling me? We can return the get. So Rav Amram asked Rabba, and Rabba answered with a sharp line, Trudah. He says, you fool, shtore chalitza mi'un in Tanan. The Mishnah is mentioning also cases of Isser v'heter, namely shtar chalitza or shtar mi'un.
That guy didn't know that the Mishnah said it.
No, that's the thing. The Ein Elio says, of course Rav Amram knew that the Mishnah said it, but he would answer that that's different. Those are matters of lav. Here we're talking about a matter of an Isser Kores or Mrs. Bastin. Anyway, the Gemara continues, Poka Arza de Beirav, the central column made out of cedar that held up the roof of the Beis Medrash, broke. It all of a sudden broke. It burst. So obviously there was something had happened over here to cause that to happen. Mar Oma Mishum Latai di Poka. So one of them says it was because of my mazel. So Rashi says, this is Rav Amram saying, you, Rabba, called me by derogatory name, Trada, therefore, because of that, then this split. Umar Omar, and Rabba answers, Mishum Latai de Deepaka, on the contrary, it split because of my mazel, namely because you tried to embarrass me in the Beis Medrash by thinking that, by publicly saying that my answer, based on that Mishnah, is no good. So that's according to Rashi then, that each one is saying, that each one is almost like saying Hashem stood up for my honor and caused this to happen. Yeah. Marashal says it's kind of the other way around, actually. Each one of them is blaming himself for it. Each one is saying that I did wrong by publicly contradicting you in the Beis Medrash, and therefore this happened. And the other one's saying, I did wrong by calling you such a name. So each one is taking the blame on himself. That now, you know, I mean, the column is split. It means that Beis Medrash is going to be closed for a while for renovations. So they have what to bemoan the fact that they should have acted better. The Chavis Yorah actually has an interesting tshuva. Someone asked him about, you have this example, you have a variety of examples throughout Shas where the Chachamim call each other derogatory names and say all kinds of nasty things to one another. How is that? What happened to Avas Yisrael? What happens to all of that? So he has a long answer. First of all, he explains that, for example, sometimes it's a Rebbe talking to a Talmud and he has the right to talk down to his Talmud because if he sees that the Talmud is not paying proper attention, sometimes it can be among Chaverim and they really don't mind it that much, although it's a little hard to see that over here because we don't know, actually. We see that Rabba said that to Rav Amram. We don't know, actually, whether Rav Amram took offense at it, because it doesn't say here in the Gemara. It just says that it split. So the number, and then he talks about there are actually a number of expressions that seemingly seem to be something derogatory and really actually are meant to be a hidden compliment. Actually, here, Ben Yehoyada says one possibility. The word tarda can be broken up into tar, which means tarda, which means wake up here. Tar means is an Aramaic word that means wake up, and da means this or here. So if he's saying, wake up, pay attention. But nevertheless, because he said it in that way, putting it together as one word where people can understand it to mean that he's calling him a fool, then therefore this happened.
How do they attribute the tragic events of what they said?
So that's the thing. So Marshall is saying that each one of them blamed himself, that I should have done better. I shouldn't have publicly challenged you in the Beis Medrash, and I shouldn't have called you that name. Okay. Yoimiyan Mashiach Ha'Gu'ula, we have at the Echofal of Cheshvan, we have at the end of Soter, it talks about the famous simonim of the Ge'ula, all about the simonim of Ikvis Mashicha, where Chutzpah is going to increase, and prices will go up, and one of the things is Ne'orim Pnei Kenim Yalbinu, that young men will shame and cause to go pale the faces of the elders. So what does that mean? In Avoda, that means that when a person doesn't look at where he himself is standing in Yiddishkeit, even as far as the simple things, Machshava Dibra Maisa and Maisa, he still has the Breitkeit, he still has the goal, he still has the self assurance to become a Mashpia and help to be Ma'oru other people to do the right thing. So in other words, a person doesn't have to wait until he's perfect to go and start having a positive influence on others. Not only that, you have those people who's zokin, zeshakana chachma, but they still don't have the morish of a Torah, they still haven't learned Torah sachsidus, and a person himself is a nar, he's still relatively a youngster. Nevertheless, in the Odom Pnei's Kenim Yalbinu, he has the ability to go and be mashpia on that elder person. Till now, you've been working very hard in nigla of Torah, but it's time to not be satisfied with that, and to also start learning chassidus. So that's a positive side of the Odom Pnei's Kenim Yalbinu. Okay. Continuing with halachas of the bathroom, we were talking about that a person has to be tzniyistic and make sure that other people don't see him uncovered. So in general, all the dinim that he discussed so far, a person has to be careful by night as well, with the exception that if a person is outdoors, so we said yesterday, when a person is going to the bathroom outdoors, he has to be far enough away from other people that they shouldn't see him by night. If there's no streetlights, then that's not an issue. So then he can go anywhere, and there's not that problem. Although if there's a corner, at least if there's a corner, then a private corner, then that would be better to use. If there's any person around there, even a guy, then you still can't if he's close enough that he could see you there. It does not matter of seeing the uncovered parts. Just seeing him from a closeness is also not a sneistic thing. Okay.